Nicky Ross is with us after this. Real Gone Kid, and as academics would say, that's the song that took him from the fringes of the Scottish scene into the hearts of the mainstream pop market. Well, that's what it says in this book, Ricky Ross. Yeah. What do you think? Was that true? Did it sort of catapult you into stardom?
We had hits before that. They kind of scraped into the chart. People always thought they were big hits. And actually, I mean, I think like Dignity, everyone thought, that was quite a big hit. It was something like 30. It went to 32 or something like that, and they went down the next week. But it was kind of quite good for us because we hadn't got close to having any success. But this one, I mean, that was like, I always remember driving to Edinburgh to do a gig on the last night of a tour, and you listen to the chart on the radio, and all our singles had high midweeks and then went down. And this one had about high midweek of something like 21, and we missed it. And it was at number 19. I thought, oh, well, that's it. It's probably about 25 or something. And it went to 15, and then the next week it went 10 or whatever. It keep going up, so it was
funny.
A big hit for us.
Yeah. Something like, because I was saying earlier on, I like the one that goes, woo, 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 which you wouldn't recognise, but that's Real Gone Kid. So you get a little hook like that, and it captures the public's imagination. it really can make all the difference, can't
it? Yeah.
So before that, Dignity, was all that had a message, didn't it? That was you being political, was
no,
it?
No, I wouldn't. No, I don't think really, but I think ostensibly. I mean, that song was written about 1985. At that time, unemployment was you know, everyone's talking about unemployment. How are we going to solve the unemployment problem? And it all seemed to me that if it were going to happen, then it would assume that a whole lot of people would be doing jobs that they hated doing. And I suppose Dignity was really just a song about that. Was, well, what happens if one is doing jobs? Then some people are going to be doing jobs that no one wants to do. Of course, you know, it seems to solve that problem by bringing in people from other countries to do these jobs.
Because where you're from, Glasgow, a heavy industry, like where I'm from, Rochdale, and when I look at the old mills, I think, well, it's, on the one hand, it's sad that they've shut down and they're now, like, selling potpourri and scones on a Sunday, and they're called industrial heritage centres. On the other hand, it's great that people like you and I don't have to work in them like our forefathers did.
And
you
mines.
Know, those shipbuilding yards. Yeah, in the mines.
You know, I was always, I mean, much as I, you know, I was very involved, you know, like loads of people, I was really, you know, totally devastated during the miners' strike because it sort of divided the country, and I really wanted the miners to be united and to win. Because I think it would just crucify their communities. There was always a bit of you was thinking exactly the same thing. It was thinking, well, that's great. I mean, but it assumes a whole new generation are going to go down these mines. So Dignity was kind of about that. It was about the dignity of labour. That was where the phrase came from.
Well, you changed your job because you were a teacher, weren't you? And then you were a pop star.
Yeah.
How do you do that for anybody who's good, listening?
That's right. Via lion taming. It was... I mean, like lots of teachers, you kind of end up in teaching. I actually quite enjoyed it, but I wasn't really... It was like something I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, and you can sort of kind of drift into it and end up doing it. And there was a few people that were teaching beside me at the time. You occasionally bump into them. One of the guys, we had a kind of an escape committee in the school, and one of the guys became an actor, and other people did different things, and, you know, I was kind of into doing music. But I enjoyed it. I mean, I must say, I didn't dislike doing it. I enjoyed it, and I still meet kids that were there. They kind of come up to you and they remember things about you which weren't true. It's very funny. Goes, I was in the garage one day, and there was a whole lot of people behind me in the queue, and she started to tell the rest of the queue, "Ah, he was my teacher, you know what?" But there was never any English taught. I was just, you had the guitar out, just singing songs. I didn't even play the guitar. What are you talking about? You know?
It's like you never forget a good teacher, especially if you end up on Top of the Pops. Now you must have gone to college, and this first choice of yours for the party always makes me think of student days. It was so well depicted in the film National Lampoon's Animal House with John Belushi. I don't know if you saw that, where they had a party in the fraternity house. And this was the anthem of the party. Tell us about this record and why you love it.
Well, it's just a great trashy record. It's just a brilliant dumb. I mean, pop records should be dumb. I mean, that's kind of why Real Gone Kid kind of worked, and they should just be dumb. I'm the worst. I find it's very difficult because I hate parties and I hate dancing. So the two things. But what I do is I stand at the edge of the party and go, "I like that record. That's a good record." And I'll give sort of three reasons in my head why I like it. But this is just like totally great dumb garage pop record.
Come on then, get up, let's dance. Well, that's Louie, and I'm being bold here by saying that's the original version by the Kingsmen, because who knows?
It's mythical. Yeah. I didn't know you did the mashed potato like that.
Ooh, and I got my feet in the air. But there's a whole album, 20 different artists covering that song.
And I know, it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's such a plodder. It's like some wedding band. Oh, here we go again. Do you ever feel like that when you're singing? Like you really don't want to? I saw Robbie Williams on telly recently, £3 million a week, saying, "I'm so bored singing She's the One."
Well, you do get bored, and the thing to do is quickly stop and do something else, definitely. And then I hadn't done a Deacon Blue gig for about 5-6 years, and we got back together, and I really enjoyed it, actually, I must say. I really enjoyed it. I actually like playing live the older I get, and now I do acoustic shows, which sometimes I do them completely on my own, sometimes with pals, but just, you know, maybe two or three of us. And I love playing live. I just think that's really what I do, and I like playing. I can play lots of different stuff as well. I can change the set.
And is there more Scottishness, like
Scottishness
about? Well, you know that. Like, do you when you're not?
Do we charge more for tickets?
No. Yeah, you all got a bottle of whiskey in your hand. No, you're all winking. No, I mean, are there more Scottish musical influences? Can you put more of that in when you're playing acoustically?
No, not really, because I think that's a kind of that's something that, you know, we didn't grow up with. We just grew up with records like
rock
that.
And roll.
Yeah, and same as most other people. But no, it's more the fact that, you know, especially last year having done the Deacon Blue tour, there's not the sort of sense that you have to go out and play all these hits. So I'll go out and play stuff from on back catalogue, which haven't played for years or whatever, or play Dignity in a different kind of version and get a chance to tell the story behind the songs. I find talking easier in that situation. When you play with a band, there's a sense of people can look at them, oh, come on, play another hit.
Hey, a bit like Bruce Springsteen. He talks, doesn't he? Picks his guitar, talks. Anyway, yeah. I'm obsessed with him. Right, so...
No, so am I. So
oh, great. About, oh, let's end with a Bruce song. Yeah. Okay, Billy Connolly's your first guest you'd like to meet at this party.
Well, you asked me. I mean, I can't... I hate these kind of... I mean, you say, you know, have a dinner with or a party. I mean, I wouldn't have anyone famous at all, but if forced into this position...
You can have anybody, live, dead, living, unknown,
oh, really?
Fantasy, no, whatever. You no. see, you haven't been properly briefed no, by no. my large entourage of staff.
Yes, sorry. No, but the reason I picked this was because I can't ever think of anyone famous that I'd like to meet, really. And Billy Connolly, I've only seen him once, actually, in a gig. And I find it very, very funny. I was crying with laughter. I mean, I was really just crying with laughter. My wife and I went to see him at the theatre about 8 years ago. And she was doing a show. She's been doing a theatre show recently. The second night of the show, Billy Connolly came to see the show and loved the show and came back to meet the cast and all that kind of thing. And she came home, I was kind of busying myself with the computer or something like that, you know, just things were really boring. She said, well, you never guess he was there. I know, I couldn't. And I just couldn't believe that I'd not been there. I mean, I just couldn't believe it because he's a very, very, very funny man.
So is it touching nerve with you particularly because you grew up in the same city?
No, I didn't actually. Because he was. Right. I mean, I grew up in completely different circumstances. I was a middle-class boy from Dundee and he was
right,
in the working class.
I thought you were Glasgow as well.
Yeah, I live there now. I kind of understand what, you know, he's on about. The reason I also love Billy Connolly is he makes me laugh because he's at his most innocent. And I think that people, sometimes true comedians just make you laugh, you know, when they come on the stage. Or just when he does like animal noises and stuff like that. Or you know, animal impersonations. He does the two lions, you know, shinga. You know, I just think that's beautifully
observed. The one I love is the one about, it's so old now, but you know. And then I got the shampoo with jojoba. It goes on about how poor they were and how he would have eaten it, you know. And you've picked another comedian as well. Let's have them together. Ronnie Corbett.
Yeah. I just think he's very funny. Well, when I had to kind of think of this list, for some reason he came into my head. I thought, well, that's a good reason. I just imagined that if you had a party, you'd get Ronnie Corbett in your kitchen and he would just tell these monologues. I think Ronnie Corbett was very, very, very... It still is a very, very funny man. I loved the fact he could do stuff which didn't really require a punchline. And people kind of went with it, you know. It was a very... I guess a very British thing, but and he's also ostensibly, apparently Ronnie Corbett's Scottish, he's from Arbroath, so he knows.
Very well disguised.
He always says like it comes from Surrey to me, but I find that sort of that kind of era of sort of English, you know, comedy. You have to grow up in Britain to really get it, I guess, but I find it very charming.
Well, it's great. Great things happening in the kitchen then. Two of the nation's top comedians. And some people might say you've picked another comedian for your second musical choice. Okay, I said that. Michael Jackson, except when he was in the Jackson 5. You don't think he's a bit daft now? A bit bonkers?
It's terribly sad, you know. But I think, you know, two things really offend me. Is one is people always going on about Elvis and cheeseburgers. And people, in a sense, Michael Jackson... You can never forget this guy is sublimely talented.
Oh yeah, but why has he gone off on that tangent?
I don't know. Who knows? You know, we're not even close to knowing, and we never will know. So who cares? And I just think, you know, don't waste time on that. But what I suppose disappointed me the most was when I went to see him doing a gig. He just did a Jackson 5 medley. You know,
was he still good at that?
Well, it was, because his dancing's beautiful. I mean, his dancing's wonderful, and his singing, this was 1988, so it's still quite interesting. But, I mean, I guess now, if you went to see him, you'd get 20 minutes of him doing Earth Song, and he would skip over this song, how beautiful it was.
Because, I mean, I was his biggest fan, you know, Looking Through the Window and Rockin' Robin and all that. I grew up with that. I loved it. You know, I'm just saying that because, in a way, I feel kind of he's left me behind somewhere. I can't keep up with him.
Yeah, I think he's left himself behind. But I think when you look at the whole story and the family, you know, the dysfunctional family... But, who cares? This is a great... You know, you can just take this record out and you don't have to think about all that because it's just brilliant.
OK, I want you back. So did, when you were making records with Deacon Blue, did you had you got sort of Motown and soul in your head, jangling around the records you'd grown up with?
I think it's hard not to... you have all these records in your head, and I just had a real disparate whole, you know, lot of records in my head that you wanted to, I suppose, get close to something that, that you'd, you'd heard. And at the same point, you I think what happens when you make records is you have these records that you've grown up with, but the record that you really want to hear is still going on in your head, and you want to make that record. And you like a bit of this, and you like a bit of that, and that's really what you're doing.
Well, there's a great uplifting record for the end of the party, but before that, just you've last guest of the three that you were allowed to choose, and this is somebody from your own life, isn't it, your real life?
My pal, the Swan.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's just a very, very, very good... I mean, it's, I was going to say another pal of mine, but it, kind of two of them go together. There's a guy called Frank Boyle who is wonderful parties, but Craig, this guy, is my pal, the Swan. If we had a party, he needs to be there. He needs to be involved. What he tends to do is now is he and his family just tend to play songs, just play songs all night eventually. But if you can get him away from his guitar for a wee while, he's also very, very good fun.
So how long have you known him then?
A long, long time. I mean, 20 odd years or something like that.
And why the Swan?
Swan. Because many years ago, we tried to influence him into a singer-songwriter that we liked. He's a great Bruce Springsteen fan. He likes all that kind of more kind of trad rock kind of stuff. And we had a guy called Bruce Coburn. He's a wonderful songwriter from Canada. And my other best pal and I were sort of saying, Craig, you should listen to him. You'd like him. Bruce Coburn's got this beautiful song called All the Diamonds, which has a line in it, like a silver swan in a sea of suns. And Craig just dismissed this by going, nah, I mean... He sings songs about swans and all that. But funnily enough, it all went full circle recently because we went to see Bruce and we went to meet him as well, Bruce Coburn. And,
Bruce Springsteen and Neil Pastor.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. No, that would have been too much for Craig. But we went to see him and he kind of likes his music now. But so that was why the Swan. But he's just very good company. When my wife was particularly tired and emotional one night, decided to start juggling her. Family crockery. Craig just joined in manfully.
You need your friends, don't you? You wherever you go, you need your old friends to kick you back into touch and bring you down with a bump. And
yeah.
And right, let's have the last one then. Don't You Worry About a Thing, Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of sort of feel the same way about Stevie Wonder as you do about Michael Jackson to some extent, in that he made these beautiful albums in the 70s. When just down the road from where we're sitting, we were in our first. Album, and someone said to me on the last day that Inner Visions was recorded in Ayr, Talking Book was recorded in Ayr, too, where we'd been working, just at Oxford Circus there. And I was just like, what, Talking Book? I mean, I grew up with that record. And Fulfilling This First Finale and Inner Visions, all these albums. And then people, I can't believe, I read these lists of people that pull out their classic albums and they pull out songs in the key of life, and I just think, it's not a great record, you know? It's not a great record. And everything after that is not great, Stevie Wonder. But again, a very, very talented singer and songwriter, a fantastic harmonica player, fantastic, you know, talent. And in the short time that I ever went club, I hated really going to night. I really hate nightclubs. But the time that I went, they just used to go back and play a bit of Northern Soul, and they would occasionally play this track. And they would just, and it was just brilliant to see people move to really good, you know, work again, standing in the dance floor watching people. But
Stevie Wonder, Don't You Worry About a Thing. Well, Ricky Ross, thanks very much for coming in. Thanks for choosing Billy Connolly, Ronnie Corbett, and your mate, the Swan. Who knows, we all might meet him one day.
Oh, yeah.
And the Kingsmen, the Jackson 5, and Stevie Wonder. We'll see you soon. Thanks, Ricky.
Thank you, Liz.